Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Fed says it'll raise rates when it's ready.
Just because we remove the word patient from the statement doesn't mean we're going to be impatient.
That gray area between patient and impatient. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Wednesday, the 18th of March, and it's great to have you with us. It was called must-see TV by some of the business news networks today. One of them had a countdown clock ticking down all morning. In the end, it was not the most riveting fair, but it was important. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen and Fed policymakers wrapped up a two-day meeting in Washington. Investors were hoping there'd be clues that would indicate when the Fed will raise interest rates. And that decision was something Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer asked Yellen about.
We talked about the risk of tightening too early. What about the risk of waiting too long, especially since it can take a while for Fed actions to work their way through the economy?
Well, I agree with that. Many studies over decades and decades have showed that there are lags in the way monetary policy affects the economy.
And Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us now from the Fed's headquarters in Washington. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, David.
We have had these low rates for years now, and you asked Janet Yellen about timing. Why is timing so important, deciding when it's time to raise rates?
Well, because it takes a while for the Fed's actions to kick in and affect the economy. If the Fed waits too long, you could have undesirable things like deflation kick in that are a lot harder to correct once they've started. On the other hand, you don't want to do things too quickly because that could kick us back into recession. So it really is a delicate balancing act.
Did we learn much today from the statement that the Fed released from this news conference about what the Fed is thinking?
We did. The Fed sent for it some pretty clear signals about this. They have some benchmarks they use to decide when to raise interest rates, among them the unemployment rate. The Fed had said unemployment had to be between 5.2 and 5.5% before it would raise rates. Well, unemployment is now 5.5%, so it's in that range. But now the Fed says, nah, unemployment needs to be even lower, between 5% and 5.2%. Some analysts say that's moving the goalposts, and they're frustrated. Another interesting thing today, Yellen emphasized that the Fed is also watching wage growth. That is, it wants to see if wages go up as unemployment goes down.
There's been this big push by the Fed to be more transparent. We've seen Fed chairman do interviews. There have been these news conferences after these statements are released. Today, Janet Yellen said very emphatically, we are a transparent central bank. How has that new transparency affected this whole process?
You know, the Fed had said it wanted to have interest rates be right around 1% by the end of this year. And to make that schedule, it would have to start raising rates in June. But today the Fed backed off of that, too. And now the consensus is they want rates between 0.5% and 0.75% by the end of the year. So the Fed has more time. It really wouldn't have to start raising rates until around September to meet that goal.
Nancy, there had been analysts who thought that the Fed could raise rates as soon as April. That's when it's having its next meeting. Did Chair Yellen rule that out today?
She seemed to, but she's really trying not to spook the market. So she refuses to be pinned down on timing. You may remember about 2 years ago, the taper tantrum, when former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke mentioned he might start tapering down the Fed's bond buying program. The markets went nuts, and so she wants to avoid that.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer with us from the Eccles Building, the Fed's headquarters in Washington. Nancy, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
On Wall Street today, investors evidently liked what they heard from Janet Yellen. Details when we do the numbers. If you're thinking about taking a trip to Europe, now would be a good time to do that. Dollars are buying more euros than at any time in the past decade. Now, while the exchange rate may be good news for dollar-toting tourists, it's not so great for European luxury brands like Chanel and Gucci. The price difference for luxury items is growing so large in some countries, China, for instance, that it risks undermining the brand's global strategies. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Chanel handbags sell for half as much in Europe as they do in China. This has caused a rush of well-heeled Chinese tourists flocking to Paris shops, eager to cash in on a luxury bargain. But as Milton Pedraza of the Luxury Institute points out, Chanel wants to sell them bags at its stores in China, so it's raising prices in Europe and cutting them in Asia.
And I think the Chinese consumer will benefit from that because they'll get probably lower prices and they won't have to go shop in New York or London or Paris in order to get the benefit of those relatively lower prices.
Even with an eye on global expansion, Pedraza points out that destination travel for luxury shopping goes way back. And Stifel analyst David Schick says high-end brands need to think long and hard about changing prices from country to country.
One of the keys to running a luxury business is that the customer understands that the prices don't move all that often and that you're not waiting for products to go on sale.
Schick says Chanel is still happy to see a short-term bump in sales, which is why the company is delaying its European price increase until April 8th.
When luxury companies get into trouble, it's when customers feel like they're waiting out a great price to buy. And so it's important that companies don't react as quickly as markets.
Schick says long-term profitability for companies like Chanel or Louis Vuitton won't hinge on exchange rates, but rather on how they're able to compete in a market that is increasingly crowded with competitors. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
You may have trouble finding an iconic item at the grocery store. Kraft is recalling more than 6 million boxes of mac and cheese dinner, the original flavor. The company says several consumers complained there were metal fragments in packages. Kraft has released some information about which boxes should be pulled from store shelves or returned, and while there's no estimate yet from the company of how much this will cost, recalls can be tricky and expensive. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on how they work.
When a food company like Kraft gets complaints from consumers or reports of foodborne illness, it notifies the FDA and consumers and voluntarily recalls the product. Colin O'Neill is at the Center for Food Safety, a consumer advocacy group.
The recent announcement was a reminder of just how fragile our food safety system here is in the U.S.
O'Neill acknowledges that under a new food safety law, the FDA can order a recall, though it has to ask the company for a voluntary recall first. His group wants the FDA to implement more stringent inspection and prevention measures as well. Food consultant Jim Hertel, though, thinks consumers are fine with the system as it is.
In general, I think that there is a level of confidence that the U.S. inspection regimen basically has gotten it right.
Hertel's consulting group does work for Kraft and other food manufacturers. He says consumers know they can get sick from food at the grocery store, but he thinks most will shrug off this metal fragments in the mac and cheese recall from Kraft.
The things that they can't see are sometimes more terrifying than the things that they can see. When it is a biological or a bacterial agent, I think there's a lot more fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
The thing that might sow some fear for Kraft, any lingering taint to this iconic comfort food brand. According to consumer research group NPD, 1 in 3 American households will eat mac and cheese in the next 2 weeks. And lots of competitors, organic, gourmet, frozen, fancy, mixed with truffles, are nipping at the heels of Kraft's classic dry mac and cheese powder in a box. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Common Core education standards have led to protests. There's been political sniping. Well, this month, millions of students are finally sitting down to take the first round of Common Core tests. Now, they vary state by state. They take on different forms. They have different names. But they're all designed to track kids' progress, their readiness, if you will, for college and careers. And no matter where you live, it's likely there will be parents who refuse to let their kids take these tests. Here's Amy Scott from the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore.
In a small brick house in Glen Burnie, Maryland, Sheena Mack's daughters get ready for piano lessons. While 7-year-old Sophia practices, 9-year-old Tavy hunts for their books.
This is your journal. Do you know who your sister's journal is?
No.
Tavy is small and thin with long dark hair, a little girl caught up in a big fight playing out all over the country. This week, her 4th grade class will take the first round of the new park assessment tied to the Common Core. Tavy won't be joining them.
I was glad I didn't have to, because usually whenever I take a test, sometimes the questions are really hard and I get really confused.
Her mom, Sheena Mack, checked out some sample questions and thinks they're too hard for Tavy's grade level. She also doesn't like what she sees as corporate-driven school reform. Pearson, a multi-billion-dollar education company, helped develop the test. But Mack didn't go into all that with Tavy.
As a parent, it is my duty, it's my responsibility to make the decisions for my children that I think are in their best interest.
As more parents make that same choice this spring, they're wrestling with what it will mean for their kids. After all, the kids are the ones who have to show up and refuse the tests.
The first thought that came to my mind was, boy, this puts a kid in an awkward position.
Joanna Faber runs workshops for parents and teachers about how to talk to kids. With all the drama about testing, parents shaming each other on Facebook and protesting in front of schools, Faber says kids may feel torn between two authorities, parent and school. So she suggests giving them a choice.
If your child's very uncomfortable about the idea of opting out, you might tell her, listen, if you want to just sit and take the test, that's okay. I can protest in other ways.
Lynn Rigby wanted to opt her kids out of Florida's new Common Core test. She says it's taking too much time away from learning. But she worried about how her 7th grader would feel going against the grain.
He's such a rule follower, and I expected him to want to take the test.
So she let him and his older brother decide.
I don't want them to feel uncomfortable, and they're not here to fight my battle. They're 13 and 14. They're capable of making those decisions.
Both boys chose not to take the tests, and Rigby says so did lots of other students at their school, so they didn't stand out. But other parents worry about how that decision will affect kids later on when they confront other challenges, like in college or the workplace.
I think it's actually very destructive in a deep way to signal to kids that a test is hard or scary or that they can't do it.
Amy Briggs lives in Brooklyn, New York, a hotbed of the opt-out movement. She works for a nonprofit that helps teachers implement the Common Core, so she doesn't share the distaste many have for the standards themselves. And as a mom, Briggs says she'd rather see her kids fail a test than be protected from taking it.
I feel like my job is to cheer them on, to support them. I'm not going to remove every obstacle. Tests are part of the deal.
A lot of parents think they shouldn't be part of the deal, at least not so many of them, and that test scores shouldn't play such a big role in how schools are rated, whether kids get ahead, and whether teachers keep their jobs. They say opting out teaches kids a different lesson about standing up for their beliefs.
I'm Brooklyn Ritter.
Hello.
Brooklyn lives in Baltimore and goes to a public Montessori school. She's in 3rd grade.
I'm 9. I turned 9 March 4th, actually.
Her mom, Elena Ritter, says Brooklyn was so worried about this test, she didn't want to become a 3rd grader. That's when annual state testing begins. But Ritter says refusing the test is not about saving Brooklyn from something scary.
You know, I always say 90% of fear is between your ears. Like, they always hear me say that.
In your head, not between your ears.
Well, your head is, that is your head. Your brain is in your head. So that's the point. But if I can't get behind the test myself and they don't want to do it, I'm like, I can't. I didn't feel like I could push them to do it.
In the end, the lesson a kid takes away from opting out may depend more on the kid than the parents. Again, Joanna Faber.
If your child feels empowered by it, then it's empowering. If they feel awkward and frightened about it, then it's not going to be empowering.
And with kids taking 113 standardized tests on average by the time they finish high school, they'll have plenty of opportunities to think about it. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And speaking of thinking about things, let us know what you think about opting kids out of tests. We've got a poll and a place for your comments at marketplace.org. Coming up, what it looks like when $500 million of artwork goes missing.
It's really jarring, and it's amazing. After 25 years, it still hits you like a slap in the face when you walk through.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets turned around on the Federal Reserve news. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 227 points, 1.25% to close above 18,000, 18,076 to be exact. The NASDAQ gained 45 points, 0.9%, ending at 4982. And the S&P 500 added 25 points, 1.2% to finish at 2099. Shares of most big banks rose on what the Fed said, not regional banks. First Niagara Financial Group, based in Buffalo, was off 2.4%. Old National Bancorp in Evansville, Indiana, off 1.7%. Valley National in Wayne, New Jersey, down 0.6%. Park National in Newark, Ohio, 0.5% lower. And Zions Bank Corporation in Salt Lake City, off 0.75%. European markets were mixed. Bond prices jumped. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.91%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Finance Committee holds a hearing on the Affordable Care Act at 5 years. The Standard Time Act was passed on March 19, 1918, establishing time zones and daylight saving time in the U.S. And Apple's time has come. Tomorrow will be its first trading day as part of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura. Dallas Seavey has won the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race for the third time in 4 years. He finished the 1,000-mile trek through the Alaskan wilderness today. Seavey arrived in Nome this morning. The prize this year for crossing the finish line first is a brand-new pickup truck and $70,000. But just getting to the starting line of the world's last great race, as it's called, can cost even more than that. Emily Schwing reports.
Before musher Lance Mackey leaves a checkpoint in a race, he greets every dog on his team. Mackey's the winningest musher in Alaska's long-distance sled dog racing history, but he's certainly not the richest.
Oh, man, the cost is ridiculous.
It can take between $70,000 and $100,000 to keep a kennel full of racing dogs running year-round.
You know, price of fuel, price of dog food, entry fees, all that stuff isn't normally justifiable by racing for, you know, a first place of $25,000 or something.
The first place prize in Alaska's other 1,000-mile sled dog race, the Yukon Quest, is less than half what it is in the Iditarod, and there's no truck. Mackey says prize money barely covers the cost of the race and expenses throughout the season, so he relies heavily on sponsorships to get his team to the start line.
I have a new dog food company this year from Italy, of all places.
That sponsor's logo is sewn on his sled bag and all the coats his dogs wear. Some mushers are sponsored by major international companies. Others make deals with small local businesses. But Mackey knows those relationships are often short-lived.
Sponsors are not only hard to come by, they're hard to keep.
That's why some mushers also work a second job. Rob Cook runs Siberian Huskies. They may be boisterous, but they're also a slower breed, unlikely to win any big races. So when Cook isn't training dogs, he works as a qualified aircraft engineer in the Canadian Yukon.
There's that old quote that it's as expensive as cocaine, but a lot more addictive, and I think that's the truth. I, you know, so much fun. Yeah, it's got to be worth it when you sit and think just how much money, you know, how much money we do spend on it.
So how much money does Cook spend?
The meat cost for the race season was about $5,000. New sled was $3,000. So, yeah, I don't want to think about it. Thanks.
Four-time Iditarod champion Jeff King used to own more than 100 dogs. Now he works with 35.
The dogs need to eat and be cared for every day. Vet bills, vaccinations, and equipment. Anything that is remotely disposable about our income goes into dogs.
30 years ago, a bag of dog food used to cost about $9. These days, high-quality kibble can cost up to $60 a bag, and it only lasts for 2 days. This may be the last season of competitive long-distance mushing for French-Canadian Normand Cassavant. For him, mushing may bring out a song, but it's also left him broke.
I don't know how I did that, but now it's time. It's have to change. The thing is, sure, I need to bring money now with my dog.
Cassavant wants to replace his tourism business with a mushing school where he'll start training the next generation of long-distance mushers. But it's not clear if he'll include a class on how to finance a dog team. In Nome, Alaska, I'm Emily Schwing for Marketplace.
Five years ago today, two men dressed as police officers stole 13 pieces of art from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Taken were rare Rembrandts of Vermeer, works by Manet and Degas, altogether valued at $500 million. It shocked the art world. A few days after the incident, the Gardner Museum's president and director said it was as if there'd been a death in the family. A quarter century later, the case remains unsolved. Kelly Crowe covers art for The Wall Street Journal, and she joins us now. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, thanks for having me.
For listeners who haven't visited this museum in Boston, what is it? What does it look like?
You know, it reminds me of this beautiful garden conservatory. I mean, it really evokes Isabella Stewart Gardner so well. She has this sort of lovely, huge, open space, just chock-a-block with everything that she went over to Europe and hauled back, sort of in the grand tour tradition. It reminds me a little bit of Barnes up in Philadelphia, you know, where they wanted people to see the collection as they had arranged it. It's a very personal feeling when you walk through her museum.
In such a small, intimate space, it must be quite stark to see these objects no longer there.
It's really jarring, and it's amazing. After 25 years, it still hits you like a slap in the face when you walk through. So many museums say, oh, we're only able to show 1 or 2% of our pieces. And so I think if it had happened, God forbid, at the Met or MoMA or anywhere else, they would have just had, you know, yet another masterpiece they would have stocked up there. And we might have been sort of out of sight, out of mind. But because Mrs. Gardner did not want anything removed or shuffled or moved around, the museum sort of, you know, has its hands tied behind its back, and it's got these beautiful ornate frames, but the paintings are not there.
What was the reaction at the time when these paintings were taken?
I think then as now, everyone was really flummoxed by why the thieves thought that they could sell them. There were, of course, it being Boston and it being sort of 1990, there were rumors that it may have some ties to Whitey Bulger and the Irish mob there, sort of the IRA. Later on, the FBI sort of began to believe that it was just another sort of mid-Atlantic gang. Their latest theory is that the works have shifted from the Boston area to Connecticut and are now in the Philadelphia region. So I think that the shift has actually focused down into Pennsylvania, which is fascinating when you think about sort of 25 years have passed, if they really haven't gone that far, and yet we can't seem to find them.
You spend a lot of time in auction houses covering art auctions. Do stolen paintings like these tend to show up from time to time?
Well, that's the craziest thing, because the thieves take these pieces thinking, oh, they might be a bargaining chip, right? Like maybe I can get my buddy out of jail if I turn in this artwork because, you know, the feds really want this painting. Or they'll think, hey, you know, I owe this guy $6 million collateral for some drug deal. Let me just hand them my Picasso. In reality, you can't really sell these on the open market. Any dealer or collector or auction house who got a glimpse at one of these paintings would immediately call the cops. They can't be sold. And art that can't be sold has nowhere to go. It could be in a storage bin somewhere in a cardboard tube for all we know.
This was such a scary and sobering moment for the art world. What changed as a result of that?
Yes, I think both museums and private collectors got a real wake-up call out of this moment. You know, it's still the largest private property theft on the FBI's docket. You know, I mean, it was a huge deal. So I think certainly museums have gone back and taken a much tougher look at their protocol. In this case, the security guard, there was only one security button sort of at his station. So once he got lulled away from that one spot, he didn't have anything on his person, right? There was no other way to trigger an alarm. He was out to sea. So I think certainly museums have revamped quite extensively. The worry for me comes when we go to some place like in Europe. Europe is full of old castles and churches and monasteries and places that have amazing pieces. And a lot of those older spaces, particularly religious institutions, can't afford the high-dollar security systems that major museums can.
Kelly Crowe covers art for The Wall Street Journal. Kelly, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you can see pictures of some of that stolen artwork on our website, marketplace.org. This final note, a lot of reporters use the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, to request documents from the government. Last year, I asked the State Department for copies of some correspondence related to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and it took me a while to hear back. I received a response last week. There's evidently a huge backlog at the State Department in the office that handles requests like mine, and we now know why. An inspector general has looked into this, and it is so slow because, and I quote, the office lacks copy machines that can handle the volume required. In 2015, there are not enough copy machines.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
All right, that's Marketplace for Wednesday, March 18th. Today, the Dow climbed 227 points, 1.25%. The NASDAQ gained 45 points, 0.9%. And the S&P 500 added 25 points, 1.2%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, Jake Gorski, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm David Gura. We'll be back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.